It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990. With special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them. Historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Senior book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. Welcome to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Pro Wrestling History Podcast. This is Tony Richards, your host. And today I'm really excited to welcome a special guest to talk about Georgia wrestling in the mid-70s. And we're documenting the progress of these territories through the 70s and into the 80s. And we're up to the middle part of 1975. Bobby Simmons is joining us today, and Bobby worked on the inside of the operation in the office. He was also a referee in Georgia and just has a lot of history with Georgia wrestling. Bobby, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It is my pleasure, and I'm hope I'll be able to add a little insight and maybe bring some clarity to some things if people have questions. So,
shoot, yeah,
man. Glad to be here.
So glad that you took the time to join us, and I'm sure this won't be the only time, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about where Georgia wrestling is concerned. And in this particular time period that we're talking about today is really interesting. For fans who may not know, and that's what we want to do this program for, is to educate the younger fans about the things that went on, you know, back in those days, that to us that kind of lived that at that time, we have kind of experienced it. But to others who didn't, it was a really unique time. There were about three organizations in Georgia at one time, right? There was the All South, who you worked for a while. There was the IWA and then the NWA. Is that correct?
That is correct. And of course, the backing up a few years, the split, as it's known, in the beginning of the war occurred in the Gunkel actually went into business in November of 1972. After Ray Gunkel had died in August that year. Yeah, we were in business for almost two years to the day. We went from November 72 to November 74, and Gunkel went away. All South Wrestling, it went away, and then there was the NWA. And then the IWA came in, and it ran some shows, but it was never very successful in Georgia, so it didn't last long. But, yeah, there were three at one time.
What was interesting to me is that the big night for your territory in Georgia was Friday night. Of course, that was Atlanta. But the IWA ran Atlanta the night before, right, on Thursday night.
Right. They always tried to run just before we did wherever they ran. And they did this everywhere they ran, they tried to do this against the major promotions. And they had a lot of pretty big names, but the problem was back in the day we're talking about, the fans were so educated to the local TVs and the talent that was working for the NWA that it just people had read about these folks in a magazine, but they weren't willing to spend their money to go see them because they knew the big night was the next night and they were going to see the stars they were accustomed to, and whatever angles we had shot, they knew they were going to see guys working against each other or wrestling each other that they'd been wanting to see. So
I think the interesting thing about Georgia is it had a really not smart fan base, but like you said, educated fan base. I mean, in the 60s and even in the 50s, they'd seen everybody, right? I mean, it was a territory that really had a lot of stars come through.
Georgia, talking the time period there, the 50s, 60s, Georgia was the territory was unique to a lot of other territories. Our trips were all were short compared to some other areas. Our longest trip was Savannah, which was 262 each way, and that was a long trip for us because the interstates weren't completed. But that was the longest trip we had. Plus, a lot of guys migrated from the north to work in Florida during the summer because they loved the beaches. And of course, Eddie Graham was the promoter down there, and everybody loved working for Eddie. And we would get the talent coming through a lot of times going to Florida. Mm-hmm. And they would get here, and sometimes they'd realize the trips were shorter. And we had beaches, too, and they would stay. So, yeah, we just about everybody that ever made a name for themselves in the wrestling business at one time or another, they were either here for a run or they were passing through and the fans here got to see them.
And is that what happened with All South and Ann's promotion? Did the talent pool kind of dry up there, or
that's exactly what happened. When we started out, when the initial split occurred and Ann broke off and started Gunkel Enterprises or All South Wrestling, all the talent except for Bob Armstrong and a guy named Daryl Cochran, who was a local guy here, a good wrestler, they stayed. They didn't make the jump. And so the first year, we were drawing as much or more money than NWA was because we had the talent that the people recognized. And if you go back and look at some of those old cards, they brought every big gun in the country in here on Friday nights to their shows. But again, the fans had only read about them in the magazines, and they knew who they were, but they weren't emotionally attached to them, I guess would be a good way to put it. And of course, we originally ran on Friday nights at Oglethorpe University, which was on the north side of Atlanta. And then after a short time, we moved to Tuesday nights at the City Auditorium in Atlanta. And we drew great for the first year. But yeah, as you, the talent pool dried up. We couldn't get major talent to come in here because NWA threatened to blackball them and we're not going to use you. And which was a fallacy, because if you can draw money, they would have used Hitler if they thought he could have drawn money for a promoter. But, you know, that's kind of what happened. My analogy, and I used to say this when we were doing our show, you can take a watermelon, but you can only slice it so many different ways. Then you got to throw the watermelon away and get a new one. And we couldn't get a new one. We had sliced and diced, and Tom Ernesto did everything he could, and it just eventually...
So you and Tom are in the All South office, and it's winding down in November of 74. When did you kind of know it was not gonna go forward much longer? About what was it in the summer of 74, the early fall? When did you first think this ain't gonna keep going?
When I was working for Gunkel, I ran errands for the office, and I was refereeing, driving the ring truck, and I was on the road refereeing. So I didn't have inside access to the office. My boss was Charlie Harbin, who was the office manager and a partner in Gunkel Enterprises, and he had been Ray Gunkel's office manager. That's how I originally got into business. Me and Charlie just became friends. But anyway, nobody said anything to us, but you could see the talent level dropping. We had some guys that were just horrible there toward the end, working the opening matches. And they were green. We don't know where they came from, but we were having Tom was forced to use what he had to use. You know, we really didn't know it was over. The last show Gunkel ran was in Montezuma, Georgia, in a National Guard Armory. Dick Steinborn was a promoter, and I remember I got there that night. I didn't have to take the ring because Dick had his own ring. When I got there that night, Charlie Harbin was there, and Charlie never made the town, so I knew when Charlie was there something was up. And he came in the dressing room just before the matches started and told us, he said, "This is it." And it was a Friday night, and he told all the guys, he said, "Be at the office at 9 o'clock in the morning. And Jim Barnett's going to be there, and he's going to help you guys get booked around the country or wherever you want to go, or try to help you where you want to go." And then he called me off to the side, and he told me, he said, "You stay away from the office. Don't come to the office." And I didn't have any idea what that meant or what that was all about. But later on, I found out that they had already made a deal for me to go to work for the NWA office. So.
Well, for our fans who don't know, and you would know very intimately, tell everybody who Charlie Harbin was in Georgia wrestling.
Charlie and his brother George were originally from up around Norcross, Georgia, a little town north of Atlanta, and they in the 40s became wrestlers. They wrestled, and then Charlie George eventually wound up working for Jim Crockett in the office in Charlotte. Charlie became friends with Ray Gunkel, and Ray hired him to be his office manager. And he refereed in the 60s. He was a referee after he had retired from wrestling. And Charlie pretty much ran the day-to-day operations of the Atlanta wrestling office. Ray would come to the office a couple days a week, but Charlie was there every day. And he was the office manager. When I was 14 years old, I started, a friend of mine had the job of putting the ring up at the TV station, and I started helping putting the TV ring up. I met Charlie through Larry Nichols, who he refereed for Gunkel as well. Charlie just liked me, and we became friends, and I lived close to the wrestling office. I started running errands for him in the afternoons after school, and eventually when Gunkel went in business, Charlie gave me a job working on the ring truck, and that led to me refereeing, and that's who Charlie was. He was just a lot of people that might remember him as a referee in the 60s, but he was a guy that pretty much ran the day-to-day operations of then what was ABC Booking.
Were you aware, or did you know when Jim Barnett came in to Atlanta?
The wrestlers, everybody got along. All the rumors of the guys having fist fights in parking lots and not is false. There was one run in between a couple of guys at the TV station one day, but everybody got along. We filmed our TV at the same studio in the same ring. I mean, it was they did their show first because they had Columbus TV, and then we did ours second. We were with All South, but the guys all got along, so everybody talked, and a lot of the guys lived in the same apartment complexes, so it was not like, you know, it weren't like two enemy camps lined up on the side of a ravine lobbing shots at each other. All the shots that were being fired were political and behind the scenes, and we were so we would hear things. We knew when somebody came in. We knew when they changed bookers. We knew when Barnett arrived in Atlanta. I had never met him. I didn't know him. If I'd passed him on the street, I wouldn't have known who he was. But I knew his reputation. And when he came in, you could see things begin to change as far as how things were run over there, the talent they were using, and how things steadied and became more calm with them. And so, yeah, we knew.
So Mr. Barnett, he had Harley Race as his booker.
That's right.
So then Harley leaves to go to Florida, and then Tom Renesto, he comes and becomes the guy who was formerly booking against the NWA office, then becomes the booker of the NWA office.
Right.
And you come over as well, and then I guess Charlie Harbin does too. Does he come too?
When Gunkel shut the doors that Friday night, I refereed that match and that card in Montezuma. That Monday morning, I had a meeting at 9 o'clock at the NWA office, and I was introduced Harley Race. And Harley was the booker, and we sat down and we talked, and Harley said, he told me that day, he said, Bobby, he said, Fred Ward doesn't want to use you. He said, Fred was a partner in the company and also the promoter in Columbus and Albany and Macon. And he said, Fred don't want to use you. He says, you are an opposition employee and he don't want to use you. And he told me, he says, Bobby, don't worry about it. He said, just keep your head up, keep your mouth shut, do your job as best. I'm going to use you as much as I can. And he said, once that, he said, Fred will come up where he'll need somebody. And he said, then he'll use you. He said, Mr. Ward has forgotten he ran opposition to the Atlanta office in the 50s. And I said, well, you know. So I met Harley that day. Me and Harley had the conversation. Harley told me how he got in the business. I mean, we had a long talk. I mean, it was a good day. And when Harley worked for Harley for as long as he was here, he was, you know, me and him got along fine. Considered him a friend up to the day he died. Then Tom came over. When Harley left.
So did you go over before Tom then?
Yes. I went from Friday night. I worked Monday night for the NWA.
And that was in November of 74?
That was in November of 74.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
I was out of 30. There were 32 people on the roster at Gunkel, wrestlers, referees. I was the only one that walked out of that office and into the NWA office. Never had to move, never had to change addresses. I just walked in and had a job.
And got the weekend off.
And got the weekend off.
That's
so
great.
It was, I was very blessed. And
so how did you find out Harley was leaving then?
They had a meeting. We had a meeting. Barnett was big on meetings. He called a meeting at the office on a Monday. And I was, of course, part of my deal was I worked in the office running errands, just doing whatever had to be done. Also, part of my job was taking care of the rings. Any rings anywhere in the state that needed repairing, working on whatever, it was my job to go do it. So I was around all the time. Well, he called a meeting, and we met on Monday morning in the office, and he explained that Harley was leaving, and he introduced Tom Ernesto as the new booker. And that was, I can't remember how long it was after I went over there, but it wasn't too long. And then a little later, Charlie Harbin was named the got to set it up, I guess, a little bit. The of course, when Gunkel was in business, we had the contract with the Augusta Bell Auditorium, and a guy down there, his name was Steve Manderson, was a promoter. Well, when the contract came up for renewal, Barnett outbid Ann and got the contract, and when he did, he fired Steve Manderson, and when he did, he brought Charlie Harbin in as a promoter for Augusta, and then later Charlie was named the promoter of Rome, Georgia, and Chattanooga when we eventually started running Chattanooga. So those were the three towns Charlie took care of for the office.
Yeah, I noticed around March, I think, Savannah got moved to an every other Sunday slot, and then Rome got the Thursday slot, right?
Yes. Savannah was a strong... Back in the 60s, early 70s, the promoter in Savannah was a guy named Aaron Newman, who is Jerry Oates' father-in-law. They moved from his building into the Civic Center. Civic Center was one of those big, huge, well, I say huge, for Savannah it was huge. It seated about 8,000 people, I guess, maybe 10. But it was a huge, cavernous building, and we never drew there. The atmosphere wasn't good. It was just, it never, ever drew. The only time in the history of me being in this business over 50 years that I ever saw that thing sell out for wrestling was when we were working for Gunkel and Ray Candy got married in the ring after the matches were over.
Oh, my.
That sold. That's the only time I've ever seen it full. It was just, we talked about this on our show, and Jerry will confirm this. It was just a horrible building. And he did move it to Sundays. Well, Rome was one of those towns we had a hard time getting into, and when we finally did, it took off.
Well, I mean, he promoted other towns around there too. Like he did Jekyll Island and
he did Jekyll Island, Statesboro, Brunswick every once in a while. I even remember going to Fort Stewart, to the Army base there. He promoted a show there on a Sunday one time. I took the ring down and went down and refereed there.
But best I can study, everybody that tried to run Savannah had a hard time. Crockett had a hard time. Just about everybody that tried to run there, it was not an easy nut to crack.
Yeah, Barnett sold the. He eventually sold the promoter, the Savannah. However, that whatever deal that was, he turned it over to Crockett. Crockett's TV out of Columbia went in there pretty strong, and I think they did a little better than we did. But it just it was just very very hard to draw there.
So that whole time period to me is so interesting because there was a little bit of Booker musical chairs going on because Bill Watts left Florida to go back to McGurk in Oklahoma, which opened up Harley's to go to Florida, which opened up Tom to come back to Atlanta. So there was a lot of moving parts going on in the big machine, you know, during that time
period. A lot of
period.
Stuff going on. Yeah, I you know. There were a lot of rumors and speculation about Tom coming back, and were there any shady deals? Were there any, you know, behind the scenes manipulation? You know, when Gunkel closed or before we closed, you know, all of that's pure speculation. I don't know. I can't tell you that. Don't know if there was or not. But it was a, yeah, it was. And then,
but I mean, you would know this, Bobby. But it seems like to me. In the study of Mr. Barnett's life that I've done, he just never missed a good business opportunity. And I don't know if there were any things like that either, but it would make sense to hire Tom Renesto from a business standpoint, I think.
Sure. Well, Tom, I worked for a lot of bookers. Tom was probably one of the smartest people I was ever around. I've talked to a lot of people that worked for a lot of different bookers. The two names that come up over who were the smartest of the people that were around was always Leo Garibaldi and Tom Renesto. Tom was he knew 6 weeks ahead of time what he was aiming for. He may come up with an idea would be just off the wall and say, well, I think this will work. Let's try this. But Tom knew 6 weeks ahead of time what he was aiming for. I would, you know, sometimes I'd see Tom's book, it'd be there in the office or whatever, and I wasn't snooping, but I'd just look at it. This is when I'd quit refereeing, I was the office manager. He was just, it was amazing to me. It was very phenomenal that the way he thought and the way his mind worked. And
he was just a good chess player.
Yes, he was, exactly. That's a very good analogy. He knew, you know, he knew what to do, when to do, how to do. And one thing that I learned with Tom, and I've seen this over the years, this happened with Gunkel. He would, when he was playing out an angle on in the main events, whoever it might be, and he knew he was fixing to blow it off. It was fixing to come to an end. I mean, he'd done everything he could with it. He drew with it, whatever. He was always working on something in the first or second match that was going to move up the card. He did it with Gunkel with Ted Oates and Wayne Cowan, who later became Dutch Mantell. He put these two guys together, and for some reason it clicked, and he saw it. I mean, this was like first, second match. He saw it. And the next thing you know, 6 weeks later, these guys are main eventing and doing every kind of match imaginable. Cages, hair versus hair, boxing matches, Texas death matches. These guys drew tons of money, and they never did it anywhere else. But for Atlanta and that time frame, it clicked. I can give you another scenario before the split came. He did it with a guy named Billy Spears and Roberto Soto. He first second match, these guys clicked. Next thing you know, they're selling out all around the territory because they just clicked together. And Tom could see that stuff when nobody else could.
That was a talent even in the days back then, but it's a lost art now to take something and just plant a seed and let it grow over a 10 or 12 week period so that guys can have anywhere from a 3 to 6 month run. But it just started out like a match on television or something.
That's exactly right. It just for whatever reason, it worked. You know, it maybe wasn't intended to work, but it did. I say this, I don't know for sure, but I don't think there's nobody around today that could do what those guys did. Tom, Garibaldi, Harley could do what we did back then. Everybody always talks about Madison Square Garden and how they always drew these huge houses. On a sellout in Madison Square Garden, that's less than half of 1% of the population of New York City. We were running the same towns 52 weeks a year. We were running the same towns every week. And these bookers were smart enough to book these towns and draw money every week. I mean, Bell Auditorium in Augusta would only seat about 3,500, 4,000 people. And yet it was not uncommon to sell that thing out week after week after week after week. Atlanta, the City Auditorium, only held about 5,600 people. But we filled that building up more times than we didn't during a year. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And, Ole Anderson used to say when he was booking, he said, man, they think they're drawing big money. He said, they're not doing what we're doing. Today it's a TV product. They can't do a 6 month program because they're working for the next pay-per-view, which is two months away or 3 months away. It's a totally different.
Yeah, they got 4 weeks to blow it off.
I mean,
it's just bam, 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 bam. And I'm thinking, these guys, you know, that's why they don't have any new ideas, because they don't have time to
develop
them.
They don't have time to build them. That's exactly right. And you know, there again, no disrespect to the talent. I'm glad they're making money. I'm glad they got places to work. But the guys today, I'm not sure they could have done what we did. It's funny. Every once in a while, somebody will call and want me to go to an independent show, an independent promotion that some, you know, I don't even know who these people are. And they'll just want me to just show up and so they can introduce me or whatever. And I watch them. And when you talk to these guys and they ask you questions, the guy will say, well, I've been in the business 5 years. Well, okay, how many matches you had? Well, you know, we work on a weekend. I don't know, maybe 100. Oh, so you've had 100 matches in 5 years. And then I tell them, well, as a referee, we had only on the big shows, Columbus and Atlanta, did we use two referees. Everything else, we used one referee. So we were refereeing 5-6 matches a night. So plus what we did when they used two of us, even we had 3 or 4 matches apiece. So, you multiply that by 6, because we weren't working on Sundays when we first started. But, you know, plus the TVs, I'm doing 55, 60 matches a week as a referee.
And that polishes you up. You know, that gets your reps in.
It's how you learn. And you learn working in front of live crowds. The independent guys, and I'm glad they're working, and they have a real zeal for our business, and that's great. But these guys, they're at a real disadvantage for learning a craft. And of course, they got nowhere to go. Chances of getting hired by the World Wrestling Federation are slim and none, unless you're 6'8" and 3 foot wide and 6 inch wide at the waist. You ain't gonna get hired. So.
And no disrespect to the guys that are out there now. I mean, we still got Tom Pritchard, we still got Rip Rogers, we still got Les Thatcher, we still got some guys out there teaching and training, but those guys are getting kind of long in the tooth, and the guys that are out there teaching and training only know how they were brought into the business, you know.
Exactly.
So
right.
So we're really losing a whole lot. I'm worried about that part of it, but I mean, it is what it is, and I don't criticize the modern.
Yeah, I mean, neither. I'm glad that they're still trying. But, yeah, it's my era's gone. It's never coming back. I mean, I can remember as a kid sitting in front of that TV, waiting on that TV to come on and watching it and getting excited about what I'm going to try to go see Friday night. That's all gone. It's all gone.
So you had Augusta on Monday. You had Macon on Tuesday. And then you had, there was a period there where you had Macon and Albany on Tuesday.
We ran Augusta, and we also ran either a town called Waycross or Valdosta. Both of those are way down south Georgia, and they alternated. Waycross, we'd usually run 6-7 months. We'd run Valdosta 3 or 4.
Off of Waycross and Valdosta, what television did they get?
They got the TV out of Savannah.
Okay. And then so
and then
Macon,
Valdosta could get the TV out of Albany.
I got you. So then Macon had its own TV.
When I first went to work over there, they did their own TV on Thursday afternoons. We would do Thursday and it would play back Saturday. But Macon and Albany was Tuesday. Wednesday was Columbus. They just ran to one town. It was always a pretty good sized show. Thursday night when I first went to work over there, we ran Savannah on Thursday night and we also ran Athens. We'd do Macon TV, and then you went to one or the other. And then Friday nights was generally only Atlanta. And Saturday we did TV in the morning. We did Columbus TV in the afternoon, which was live. That was an adventure. And then on Saturday night we ran Carrollton and Griffin, Georgia's. And then we weren't working on Sundays at the time.
What television was Carrollton getting?
Atlanta.
And Griffin got the same, right? Because it's just south of Atlanta.
Right.
And then this is something that, in my newsletter the other day, I got somebody sent me an email about they didn't realize Macon and Columbus had their own titles.
Yes.
Like they had their own singles and tag team titles, right?
Mr. Ward was the promoter for those towns. He had champions in all his towns. Columbus and Macon both, they had heavyweight champions. They also had tag team champions. Albany had what they call the Albany City Champion, which was basically a trophy. Also, Mr. Ward used to run a little town called Americas, which is down near Plains, where the Jimmy Carter thing there. It was not far from Plains. He ran it pretty regularly, and he had an Americas City Champion. But he had champions in it, you know. Everything, and that's something else, too, you don't have anymore. Everything was personal. It was geared to whatever or wherever we were working. So,
I learned something new today. I didn't know that those other towns had titles too.
Oh yeah. I'll give you. You mentioned Jody Hamilton before we went on the air. I'll give you a funny Jody Hamilton story. They had a trophy in Americas. It was a little bitty thing. I mean, it was inexpensive. It was cheap looking, and you know they made a big deal about being America's champion. When Jody won it, he stomped that thing into million pieces. They were upset, and he told them, he said, that's an embarrassment to have to tote that thing. So everybody had champions. And, you know, this got nothing to do with what we're talking about, but in Bob Kelly, when he was booking the Mobile area, he had champions in his cities there. But they didn't have belts. They had jackets made. And they would, you know, on the back it would say Hattiesburg champion or Hattiesburg tag team champions or whatever. But they had jackets you could win down there if you were the champion you had. But yeah, most of the towns in the South had the promoters geared it toward that town and had champions.
I knew they had their state titles. You know, Bob Kelly was the Mississippi state champion forever. You know, but I didn't know they had the jackets.
That's something Kelly told me, and then Michael Norris, who probably knows more about Mobile than any person breathing today. He told me about them too.
I grew up in Kentucky, so I grew up with Tennessee wrestling. And I was talking to somebody the other day that is pretty deep knowledgeable about it. And we were talking about, and they lived on the other end of Tennessee. I lived on the west side. They lived on the east side. And we didn't have any idea what was going on in the other, you know, side of the state, you know, because in that territory, almost every television was a live studio show, and it would start out at Memphis and go to Chattanooga, and then they'd go to Huntsville, and then they just all Saturday they spent driving around the territory doing television, and then do a show that night or something, and there were different angles and different programs going on that we didn't even know about if you're on one end of the state. Was it that differentiated in Georgia?
Yeah, back then it was. This was before cable TV had really hit, and when these local stations, they only had so much power and they only went out so far, and you could gear each show for that particular area or towns around it, whatever you were going to do. Augusta, Savannah, Chattanooga, we bicycled the tapes. We'd do the Atlanta shows, and then we would go into the studio on Tuesdays and cut interviews to insert into the show. So each they may see the same this be the same tape in Augusta as it was Atlanta, but the interviews would all be different.
Mm-hmm. Local.
So we could make it local and personalized. Once cable hit and satellite TV hit, it became a little harder.
So did Harley and Tom book all of that, or did Fred and Ralph have some things to do with it too?
Mr. Ward, it changed from time to time. Mr. Ward's son-in-law, Leon Ogle, who refereed and wrestled some down there, he booked a lot of times, Mr. Ward's towns. Later on, Tom began booking all of it in conjunction with Mr. Ward and his family there.
I mean, it's just a lot to keep up with, man.
Yeah, it is. But, that, you know, most of the time, you know, once Ole became the booker and was booking, he booked everything.
So you said that you saw Tom's book a couple of times. Was it a big old book or a large ledger? Or
no, Tom, it was like a sort of similar to what you maybe have a personal phone book in your home. It's about, I don't know, maybe 4.5 inches wide and 6-8 inches tall, spiral bound sort of little thing. That, you know, it's got A, B, C, D. Well, Tom had one that had, he would buy a calendar book about that size, and that's what he booked with. On the other hand, Ole would use a desk blotter. I mean, it was a calendar. You've seen them, I don't know, they're maybe 2.5 foot, 3 foot wide, and a foot and a half tall that you would lay on the desk and use as a blotter and appointment calendar. Well, that's what Ole booked with. And that was like looking at a jigsaw puzzle because, you know, at one time Ole was booking Atlanta and Charlotte all at the same time. So, yeah, right. It was interesting.
So after you get over there and you get settled and everything, what were your, you know, you just kind of known Jim Barnett by reputation, but now you're working in the, you know, in the promotion for him. What kind of person was Jim?
Well, first time I met Jim, as I told you earlier, Charlie Harbin told me to stay away from the office. Well, that Saturday morning I got up and I'd been told not to go to the TV station, not to do nothing. And I'm, of course, I sit there and, you know, your mind gets to racing. You get to wondering what's going on and how am I going to eat? How am I going to support my family? So I got up and went to the office about 10 o'clock and I walked in. The first thing Charlie says is, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "What's going on, Charlie? Somebody needs to tell me something." And Barnett stepped out of office and he said, from that day on, he always called me Mr. Bobby. He said, "Mr. Bobby." He said, "I'm Jim Barnett." And we went in the office and he explained that he wanted me to come take care of the rings, referee, blah, 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 work in the office a little bit. And that was my introduction to him. That Monday when I went in and the meeting with Harley took place in Barnett's office, he was there. He asked me, well, how much money I made working for Ann. And, of course, Monday was payday, and I had not I hadn't been to the Gunkel's office to get paid, so I'm there. And he asked me, and I told him, and he immediately doubled my salary and wrote me a check.
Oh, wow.
So he became one of my favorite people.
Sure.
Meeting Jim, you know, I had heard stories, and I immediately picked up that he was a very astute businessman. I didn't know wasn't real sure, you know, how I fit into plans over there, what was going on. But I was impressed. Mm-hmm. I was impressed. And then, of course, working for him so many years and getting to know him, my admiration for him just grew and grew and grew. But he was a very astute businessman. He kept his hands on the pulse of his business. So he was a good guy.
So then you came out of the referee position and just started working in the office, right? You ran the ticket office, is that right?
I left in 1977. I decided I wanted to wrestle full time, and I left Atlanta in April, and I went to Mobile. My deal was to work for Lee Fields' office. I started on a Friday night in Dothan, and the original deal was that we set up, and Gene Anderson, who was booking in Atlanta. Gene was the original. He was hired as the booker. Gene was hired as a booker. Of course, Ole came. They were a tag team. Ole was the dominant personality in those two, and eventually Ole became the booker. But anyway, Gene helped get me booked, and the deal was I was going to Mobile for 2 weeks to get my feet wet wrestling every night as opposed to refereeing, and then I was supposed to leave there and go to Nashville to work for Gulas. Tom was booking for Gulas at the time, and that was kind of the deal to go up there. So when I got there, I'll never forget, on Friday night, I worked with Dick Dunn. I'd watched Dick Dunn wrestle my whole life. And I was supposed to go out in the first match and put Dick Dunn over. And about 7-8 minutes into the match, Dick Dunn whispered in my ear, we're going to go Broadway. We're going through. I'm not going to beat you. And of course, I didn't know what that meant, but we finished the match. And when I got back to the dressing room, Dick Dunn's in the shower talking to Rocky McGuire, who was the booker for several towns on that end, Dothan being one of them. They called me in the shower and they asked me if I'd stay all summer. They said, you know, not main event, but middle of the card. You know, we want you to stay. You can work. We need workers, blah, blah, blah. And so that was my plan. I stayed there. Found out my wife was pregnant a couple of weeks later. She was having some complications, so I decided to come off the road. I gave my notice in Mobile, and I came off the road. Long story short, I stayed out of the wrestling business until my child was born in January. I got a call from the Atlanta office from Barnett in early January, and the lady that was running their ticket office had some problems, and they were going to have to make a change, and they wanted to talk to me. So I went to Atlanta and I met with Barnett and his office manager at the time, Doug Smith, and they offered me the job. Working in a ticket office, no refereeing, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, sell tickets at the auditorium on Friday night and make sure everything with the tickets was, you know, like they were supposed to be. And so I took the job. I started back there the 29th day of January. Started back the 30th of January of 78, and I was considered the box office manager.
And then you were there for through like the early 80s, right?
And dates run together. I either left in December of 81 or 82. That's when Ole had pulled the coup and he took over the promotion from Barnett, and Ole knew my loyalty was to Barnett, and it was a mutual agreement that I would leave. And when I left, I thought, you know, I've had a good run. I took a job, and it worked out real good for me because I was able to retire about 9 years ago, and it was a good move for me. So
let me back up, and then you've been very generous with your time. I'll let you go. But I'll back up to something you said just a second ago that I didn't know, but you piqued my interest. So when Tom Renesto left, did he leave to go to Nick Gulas in 77? Is that what happened there? Or
Whenever he left, he wound up – I'm not sure how it worked out as far as political side of it to get it done. But Tom was actually booking Nashville, and he was also booking Detroit. I talked to Tom, and he wanted me to go to Detroit. And I can't even remember what year that was. He wanted me to go to Detroit and wrestle. And he said, I'll take care of you. I'll do this. I had heard so many horror stories about Detroit that I told Tom, I said, I'm not interested.
That's a long way for a Southern boy.
Yeah, I'm going to stay here. I mean, a dear friend of mine, Jimmy Powell, who now pastors a church up in Lafayette, but Jimmy started wrestling when he was about 14 or 13 for Nick. And he eventually went all over the country and all over the world, as a matter of fact. But he went to work in Detroit, and he had to steal his own ring back at gunpoint to be able to come home. So, you know, I was afraid of that, and I got more stories about that, but that's, you know.
Yeah. Well, what you said that got my interest going real quick was that Gene Anderson came in to book the Georgia
When Tom left, the meeting in the Atlanta office was that Gene Anderson would be the new Booker. That's what we were told. I can't remember, but I think Gene was actually at the meeting that day. Gene was the one that came to the office every day. Gene was the one that, if I was going to a spot show to carry the ring and referee, Gene was the one that gave me the finishes for the town that night. Gene was the one I talked to. Ole never came to the office, but Ole was helping Gene book, and eventually Ole was just the very Gene was very smart. Gene was a great businessman, but Gene was kind of quiet. He was funny when you got to know him, but he was not the outgoing dominant personality that Ole Anderson was. And Ole eventually took over and became the Booker, and Ole was the right person. The Atlanta territory was a difficult place to book because of the TV. The TV made things very difficult because it went so many places, and it went all over the world.
Yeah, and you even had to, the Federal Communications Commission, you guys had to abide by some of those rules and even had to divide up some of the TBS show, which was the TCG show back then, right?
We didn't have to divide the show up, but what they did, we were like under their thumb. They came in, you're only allowed X number of minutes of commercial time in an hour. And that includes advertisements for the local transmission shop or Coca-Cola or whoever, you know, on the satellite that was going out on the, when it became a superstation, the satellite that went out all over the country and all over the world, they had major sponsors. They had Budweiser, Coca-Cola. They had, big time sponsors. The locals that was going out in Atlanta and the metro area, you know, they may have the local Amco transmission, or they may have, it was more regionalized. Well, sure. With those, you take those commercial times out, and then you have X number of minutes where you can go on and say, the Omni this Saturday night or Friday, Sunday night or we'll be in Griffin tonight. If you go back, if you can find any of those old shows, Wrestling 2 was a master at it. He may be talking very generically about this and that and this and that, and then we may have 10 seconds out of that interview where we can commercialize. And he'd say, Griffin, 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 tonight I'm going to be in Griffin, Georgia. And that's all he'd say because that's all the time we had.
Right.
And, they were meticulous with watching us and timing us. It was a very difficult situation. We were blessed that if 17 didn't sell all the time, if they had 30 seconds, 40 seconds, a minute that they didn't sell, they'd call us on Friday and say, you got an extra minute tomorrow. So we was able to, manipulate and use that. But, yeah, it was – FCC was horrible. And everybody talks about the – there was two or three times that when I became office manager that I went with Barnett to Ted Turner's office. One time Moondog Maine ate goldfish on TV, live goldfish. Some lady called and complained that her kid ate fish out of the aquarium. We had a trip to Turner's
trying
office.
Trying to be Moondog Maine, huh?
We had a trip to Turner's office. The famous incident where Bruiser Brody kicked the guy in the wheelchair and it rolled across the set.
Mm-hmm.
We got calls from AARP and senior citizens groups trip to Ted Turner's office. When Abdullah came in, that was we made a lot of money, but for people complaining, man, he's eating live raw fish on TV and he's eating light bulbs and my kid's watching this. So it was a very difficult time, and Ole was good at it. He was very adept at it, and Ole made a lot of money, but he'd get burnt out. You're talking about musical bookers. Ole would tell Jim, I'm through. I got to go. I got to get my head straight. He'd leave. He bought different businesses up north where he was from up there. He bought a sawmill one time, and he went and hid in the woods for 4 months. And he would do different things. But we had several bookers here, Louis Tillet came in as an associate booker. Gary Hart was here as an associate booker. Robert Fuller came in as the booker for a while. Buck Robley was here as a booker for a while. So we had, but none of them were ever as successful as Ole, because Ole was just very adept at doing what he did.
So do you think Ole was more successful than Tom?
Long run, probably so, because Tom, the Superstation thing, when it came along, it was right near the, I can't remember what year exactly that happened, but my mind's telling me that was kind of at the end of Tom's run.
I keep thinking somehow or another it was around the end of 76.
It was near the end of Tom's run as a booker, and it was, so when it happened, nobody knew what to expect. We really didn't know what a superstation was until we got into the, but it was Ole kind of learned on the job, and that was it. It was just his thing. But, I think Tom was smarter in a lot of ways than Ole was as far as booking was concerned. That's my personal opinion. But
Ole had a longer run.
And he became very adept at it. And it was what it was.
Well, listen, I know you got another appointment you got to get to, so I don't want to keep you. You've been really generous with your time. And I want you to come back, because there's a whole lot of stuff we still should talk about. And
Anytime, my friend.
I appreciate you, Bobby. Really, I appreciate you for a lot of reasons, but I really appreciate
you
coming on.
I love talking about this stuff, and very few people Bill Bowman, near the end of his life, God love him, he had to go into an assisted living facility, and Bill told me, he said, the worst part about this is, he said, nobody understands me. And I think that's kind of the way it is with the wrestling business. There's not many people that know what was going on and can talk about it. But yes, I love this. So anytime you have my number, feel free to reach out.
All right, Bobby. I appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel at TonyRichards4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.